You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
The show is like Mother, Like Son?
Yes. That's right, with
really?
The question mark.
With a question mark.
You know, it's a mother-son thing.
Thanks for tuning in to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. Our guest today is Andy Silver, the managing editor of Fortune magazine.
Listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio JFF. This is my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
We're in the studio with our producer, Mark Sutton.
Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son with guest son, Mark. I'm the surrogate son today.
Hi, Mark. Well, you're a lucky man. I mean, not a lot of people can call Patricia an adopted or a mom for a day or a mom for an hour.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. It's great to be talking to you this morning. We've been friends for quite a while.
Yeah.
And you want to say that we're talking to you because you, well, for a lot of reasons, but in November you were appointed, is this the right title, managing editor?
That's
for
right.
Fortune Magazine.
The managing editor, that's the title we use for the top editor of the magazine service
right.
company. Yep.
And our listeners may not keep track of who the managing editor of Fortune Magazine is, but I bet a lot of them will recognize your voice when they hear you speak as the hilarious as well as really informative business anchor of CNN's American Morning and the co-host of CNN's In the Money, and, of course, your Street Speed online piece that you've done for many years, right?
Right, Street Life it's called, actually. Yeah, that's right. I've done that for a while. Thank you.
Are you still doing that while you're working as an editor?
I am. You know, I've always really enjoyed multitasking, you know, and I'm not sure if it's just ADD that's never gone away or, you know, but I'm still doing that once a week.
Right.
It's like jujitsu, turning a negative into a positive. That's good.
That's it. You know, there are no problems. There are only opportunities and, you know, all those sort of tired business slogans. But it is true. And, you know, I just love to, you know, sort of reach out and do different types of, you know, journalism in all sorts of forms. And so that's always been a love of mine. And the online thing, you know, I think they sort of call them blogs now. But when I started this, that word didn't even exist. It was just an online column.
Well, I want to ask you, since I said it incorrectly, a street speak, but you use that term, and the way you talk about the situation in the business world, how you get the language,
mm-hmm.
and that we all find it rather boring if we sit down and read the Wall Street Journal or columns, and you found a way to make it understandable, funny, and lively. Now, how were you able to do that?
Well, thank you again. But what happened was, you guys, is that I would go down and interview people on Wall Street, and we'd do these sort of very formal interviews, and they'd start speaking in jargon, saying that, well, of course, we are looking to appreciate the assets by $3.2 billion as they depreciate before the bonds come due. And I'd be sort of falling asleep, you know, writing this stuff down. Excuse me. And then later on, afterwards, maybe I'd go out and have a drink with the same person at a bar, and he'd be saying, man, that Cisco stock is rocking my world, baby. That's on fire. And I'd say, you know what? Why don't you talk like that? And, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. So what I decided to do was to bring the language of people on Wall Street and in business to life. But really that just meant, you know, talking as they did when they weren't so guarded in talking about things in sort of the way that they talked about, you know, sports or their families or everything they were interested in doing. So it was sort of translating it back in the normal Americanese, if you will.
And you did that both in your writing, and were you also doing broadcasting then? Were you on CNN as well?
So well, not initially, but that started about 7 years ago. And I, again, tried to do the same thing. You're exactly right, which was to sort of decode business speak and put it into language that ordinary people could understand. And more than that, enjoy, because it should be fun. You know, not only should you be able to understand it, but I feel that you should be entertained by it as well.
What do you think about the guy on MSNBC, I believe it is, or CNBC, who does the Mad Money, the crazy stock guy?
Yeah, Jim Cramer. I've known Jim for a very long time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's a terrifically intelligent person. And, you know, I think Jim would be the first to tell you that he sort of, you know, takes himself out there and puts himself very far out on a limb. And frankly, and I would tell Jim this, that I find that a little unnatural, you know, that it's so forced even I don't feel like you have to, you know, almost look like you're biting the head off of a live chicken, if you'll pardon the expression. You can just be yourself and have fun, just like we're sitting around, you know, on the living room of the couch at your house, Patricia, up in the Beaver Kill, you know?
Right. Well, reading and listening to you, I don't get the sense, Andy, that you try to give a lot of advice. It's as though you explain what's going on. It's not like do this, do that, buy this, sell that. Yeah.
Boy, the advice thing will come back to bite you in the you-know-where. I mean,
right.
See, because, you know, there are very, very few geniuses when it comes to the world of investing, and I certainly do not claim to be one of them. I mean, and even if you, you know, talk to Warren Buffett, who is one of those geniuses, he would be loath to give you any kind of advice except, you know, buy what you understand.
Right. Pretty standard advice.
Exactly.
Right?
And those things are really true. But, you know, it's important to just remember those things and always follow those very basic rules. If you do that, you'll probably do okay.
Well, I want to go back a little. This is sort of goes back to being more of a motherly question in your background, because I do know that you grew up in a home in which music, I think your father was a musicologist,
that's correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the trip from, I guess, liberal arts in college?
Yes, very much so.
And I know you made a documentary about bluegrass music.
Mm-hmm.
So that long transition, a wonderful transition from that liberal arts world, music, to the world of finance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, birth order always comes into play. My brother, who you also know, Patricia, was a lawyer, and so I couldn't go to law school, so I went to business school. And I always sort of liked the vicariousness of, you know, being a vicarious businessman. I loved reading the Wall Street Journal, but I didn't want to sit around and, you know, do mortgage calculations for, you know, 5 years as a 20-year-old. So I figured a good way to get interested in this and to be sort of a nonconformist at the same time was to be a writer, to be a journalist, but also to sort of enjoy business. And the other piece of it was, at many small town newspapers, the business section and the sports section are the same section.
Oh.
So I would read the sports page and look at all the baseball statistics, and then I'd turn the next page and there'd be the stock tables. And I said, you know, there's just a lot of similarity here, you know, between like what's up, what's down, who's hot, who's got a big batting average,
right,
which stock is going up. And so that was another way for me to get into the business world was through sports.
Do you think one thing that's going on right now that's similar to that, I think now I'm seeing a real connection between Wall Street and, for better or worse, the online gambling industry. It seems like a lot of college students who want to go into Wall Street to sort of prove themselves by, well, look at how much money I made on one of these gambling websites, so I could do the same for your company.
Well, you know, they do call the New York Stock Exchange the world's largest casino. I'm sure the people down there wouldn't particularly appreciate that, but
right.
You know, there are links, and increasingly there's sort of this a school of literature that combines Wall Street and investing and blackjack and roulette and gambling. There's a wonderful book called Fortune's Formula, which talks about a bunch of MIT professors who tried to fool the casinos and then also use these tools for investing. A lot of people that I know on Wall Street are, you know, diehard blackjack players and gamblers. And
particularly
really,
blackjack or just gamblers?
What's that?
Particularly blackjack or just gamblers in general?
Particularly blackjack, because blackjack, they will tell you vehemently, is not just a game of luck, but
uh-huh.
It's a game of skill.
Right.
And so they really make a big differentiation there. You know, gambling is just kind of a high-octane fun for them. There's some of them who do that as well, but blackjack is the real thing.
Keeping track of the numbers and stuff,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly. So there really are some links there. You guys are right.
And we're talking today with Andy Serwer. You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. We'll be right back.
New car, caviar, four-star, baby,
Andy Serwer on Like Mother, Like Son.
You mentioned before you wanted to approach business from a fun direction, but, I mean, do you also have a lot of insider secrets, too, or?
Well, insider secrets always get you in trouble. You overhear some guy on a bus, or if someone tells you something, sometimes it can be illegal, you know, that's inside information. Then we also have rules, too. I mean, you know, you could buy a bunch of stock in a company and then decide to write a big story about it and make yourself rich and get yourself fired and thrown in jail.
Well, right. I didn't mean insider in the
legal context. I wanted to spell that out a little bit first.
Yeah.
But you know, sure, I'm interested in investing. We have rules, of course, about what we can and can't do here as journalists. On the other hand, I think my wife would be the first friend, would be the first one to tell you that I seem to have an aversion to actually making any real money. But, you know, I'd like to think that I'm doing okay. I'm interested in it, but, you know, it's another thing. I think I'm like everyone else, you all, that, you know, sitting down and investing and talking to a financial planner, it's like, you know what, I'd rather hang out with my kids or watch a ball game or read a book. It's always sort of the last priority thing to do. I try to make sure to do it, but, you know, you have to, it's like going to the gym and exercising or something. It's hard sometimes to get yourself to do it.
Speaking of Fran, you mentioned her. You met her at Fortune, right?
I did, yeah. Uh-huh. It was an office romance that went right, Patricia.
Good. It certainly seems to have.
Yes.
Well, I want to start back with this, asking you, Andy. You talked about the 90s and the bubble of the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and you called it the age of self-interest, I think, or conflict of interest
culture. Yeah.
And now that we're talking about gambling and people gambling today in 2007, how would you describe the culture of today in terms of business and finance?
Well,
that's
it's interesting. You know, it's sort of a more measured time. I think, you know, business was ascendant in, like, say, 1999 and 2000. We didn't need government at all because we were all getting so rich, or this is what they said. And so that quickly changed in 2000 and 2001 with the crash of the bubble and with 9/11. All of a sudden, government became very important. And then all the Enron and WorldCom crooks happened, all those scandals. So business was very discredited, I think hit a low point around, say, 2002, and government was so important.
Right.
Now I think we've had a real turn of events. You look at what the government's done in terms of our foreign policy, in terms of the response to Katrina. You look how business has stepped up in the case of Katrina. Business is coming forward and proposing new environmental rules. This government used to do that, for goodness sake. The stock market's back. The farm economy's back. So I feel that business people who were almost sort of ashamed and discredited so much over the past 5 years are starting to feel like, well, you know what, it's okay to be a business person again.
Mm-hmm. They sort of cleaned house and now are the good guys.
That's right. And, you know, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, I think this nation, you know, is great because of a real nice matrix, a combination of government and business.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not bad to be a business person. And you look at your 401k and, my goodness, I made a little bit of money in 2006. So I think those things are real positives, you know, and when all those things are clicking at the same time, we can all start to feel a little bit better about ourselves in this country.
Andy, what's the story with the outsourcing of our government? It seems to me like, you know, they're outsourcing everything, you know,
mm-hmm.
all the military, I read that the auditors who are auditing the government contracts that's being outsourced. So they're actually outsourcing the auditing of the people who, you know, of the outsourcing.
Yeah, well, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, of course, we heard outsourcing of jobs, of course, has been a hot-button topic for a long time. And the outsourcing of government stuff, you know, is very controversial. And, you know, what does it suggest? On the one hand, you know, maybe it's a good thing. People complain about how the government's so inept. So maybe it's good that some things are in the hands of the private sector. On the other hand, it's a real scary thing when, you know, say a Halliburton is running, you know, portions of our Iraq campaign, or, you know, then is it a good thing that the Dubai, a company in Dubai would be running our ports? That's very unclear. A lot of people can use those issues, though, for political hot potatoes, if it will. You know, it's, oh my goodness, the same people who brought down, you know, who brought us 9/11 are now going to be running our ports. Well, that's not exactly true. And it's a good thing to, you know, get higher TV ratings and maybe get elected. But, you know, it takes a lot more vigorous examination to really get to the bottom of these things.
What interests me is with these sort of fear tactics or the fear mongers that are always around us about what's going on, that the stock market remains so strong.
Yeah, it is true. And then, you know, if you talk to people on Wall Street, you ask them, you know, some of the real graybeards and the people who I think are pretty smart,
right,
what's the scariest thing? And they said the scariest thing is that there is no scary thing. And, you know, there's two scary things. One, you know, everything in the world right now in terms of economies in South America and Asia, Russia even, everything's clicking. And that's scary because when that happens, you know something bad is going to happen next,
right,
number one. And number two is as you suggest, this, the threat of terror and this clash of civilizations, as Professor Huntington termed it, has not gone away and has not been resolved. And there will be another chapter, sadly, I'm sure.
What about the economics of global warming? Is that and I know the insurance industry is starting to take note of is there debate within the financial community about climate change, or are they?
Well, a couple of things there, Ramsey. First of all, I got a big kick out of the front page of the New York Times this past weekend. French scientists say unequivocally that global warming exists, and it was like -5 degrees where I was in Vermont. So we were all we're laughing about that. But I think that, you know, most people in the business community even now acknowledge that global warming exists, and it is a problem. And as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, you know, these 10 large companies themselves have proposed caps on carbon emissions and CO2 emissions. And so, you know, I think that people are starting to rally around here. And, they're, you know, again, the private sector business taking the lead here, it's, I find that kind of embarrassing in terms of, you know, where the government stands.
Let me take this conversation, turn this conversation around a little bit. I want to ask you about music. The music business is just, it's changed so fast, so completely. I mean, I took a swing at trying to be in a rock band, and my brother's got a band, and
yeah,
the whole model is, you know, MySpace, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is so bizarre. What do you predict the model will be? Will those, the big labels, the big five, manage to adapt and maintain a stranglehold on music?
Well, it's changing. I mean, it's, you know, who could imagine the most important person in the music business right now is Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple Computer.
Right.
He's the one who's driven the whole business with iTunes and the iPhones. And the other day, he just issued a manifesto saying that, you know, they've got to get rid of these music piracy protection things for all, you know, digital downloads, so that everyone using all different kinds of MP3 players and from different sites, you know, Apple and the iPod dominate, but still there are others out there, of course. Everyone needs to get together to do this. So I think that the model is broken, and, you know, when you have someone, an outside disruptor like that, driving it, it really speaks volumes.
I mean, the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association, did such a good job of totally making themselves out to be the bad guys, you know, through the whole Napster thing. I mean, everybody sort of hates the RIAA now.
Right, right, right.
The way they, you know, their campaign and sort of their aggressive tactics of suing
12-year-olds
and,
you know,
grandmothers.
Yeah, you don't sue your customers, you know, right? It's not a good business model, I can tell you that, Ramsey.
Yeah, and they just recently arrested somebody who had only downloaded 5 songs.
Right. Well, on the other hand, I will tell you something, you guys. I mean, you know, young people say that to me, and I say, well, okay, I'm going to walk into the CVS, I'm going to walk into the drugstore and steal 5 Butterfingers. Okay? Now, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm stealing Fortune articles off the Internet every day.
We're putting them up there for free. If you were stealing them, Ramsey, I'd come and get you.
But you know what I mean? It's sort of like the music industry is sort of like the newspaper industry. There's a parallel there. I mean,
there is.
You go buy Fortune for what, you know, $5.99?
$4.95. And actually, Ramsey, that gives me an opportunity to say it makes for a wonderful Valentine's Day gift.
Do you have a special Valentine's
Day?
Okay.
No, we don't.
Is that for your bathing suit edition?
You know, we should start one, although some of those CEOs wouldn't look so good in bathing suits, I'm afraid.
But actually, the look of Fortune is really a key piece of your success. It's a very sharp and classy and interesting design and layout.
Well, yeah, we take great pride in that. You know, we're 77 years old, and we've had some of the best graphic designers and most famous photographers, you know, going back to, you know, Margaret Bourke White and all those groups from the WPA. Some of the best photographers in the history of our nation, you know, have been here and worked here and graced these halls. So that's a rich tradition that we just are are thrilled to continue with.
That I don't want to ask you to tell tales out of home or anything, but are you getting the magazine at a time when the whole communications world is really on the cusp of change?
Yeah, and that's a challenge, Patricia, because, you know, obviously the Internet is here, it's growing, number one. Number two, it is unassailably true that young people aren't reading as much as they used to. And we're committed to long-form journalism, which is really great narrative stories, mm-hmm. which is what really turns people on. You just, you know, get down in a great chair by a fire and read a story that you just can't put down. That's what we love.
Right.
Now, having said that, we're also vigorously, you know, doing things on the Internet and putting up breaking stories, and our website is growing like a crazy weed. So, you know, it's all part of one continuum, we like to think.
You know, you're almost one of the first bloggers. I say that because 1999 or 2000, you were doing Street Life, right?
Yeah, actually it goes all the way back to 1997. Yeah, so it's, you know, 10 years old, and it was, yeah.
I don't think you were calling it a blog back
then,
right?
No, we said the word didn't exist, and, you know, someone told me that I should be an online columnist, and I said, what's that? I didn't even know what it meant when someone proposed that I do it.
How is that column doing? I mean, it's a subscription. You sort of sign up for it, right?
Yeah, you sign up for it. It's come and gone. We're cranking it back up now. I'm only doing it once a week, but I'm having other people do it with me as well. And right now it's got about 60,000 subscribers, and we're going to start, you know, trying to get more people interested in it. And it's great. It's free, and it's fun and informative, I'd like to think.
We're getting ready to wrap this up, Andy, but I want to ask you about the business of public radio.
Mm.
The talk radio on the right, and now, you know, Air America on the left, maybe, is a lucrative, you know, business. But public radio, what's the business of public radio moving forward?
Geez, I'm really not an expert in this department at all, Ramsey. I do know I did some stuff for there was a public radio show out of California that did business, and I did some stuff on them. And you know it's government supported. It's supported by the public. You know, it's a tough model, I think, but I think it's going to stay. I mean, a lot of people, you know, all things considered, is really a very, very, very important media property. I mean, you know, I don't know what its numbers are, but I'll tell you, in terms of its demographics, a lot of very, very influential people, decision makers, they call them, listen to NPR. So I don't think it's going to go away. I mean, if it lost government support, it would be interesting, because I would bet you any amount of money that some media mogul would pick it up and support it and
right.
not mess with it.
And the Internet radio convergence, you don't see that as sort of killing
the because it's just another form of distribution. Same, you know, satellite radio, Internet radio, I mean, the programming's still got to be there.
Right.
In fact, they need more programming than ever. I mean, you go mess around in your car on an XM radio, I just keep on driving because there's so many things to listen to.
This has been really fun speaking with you. We'd like to thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a real pleasure, and I hope you all are warm up there.
We're good. But, Andrew, before we leave, I want to close with a quote. I know you've heard it, but I think our listeners should hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It's from The New Yorker.
Okay.
IKEA had Homer. The Spanish Civil War had Hemingway. California had the Beach Boys. And now our hyperactive stock market has its own poet, singer, Andy Sore. So it's so great to talk to you.
Oh, that's very nice of you to read that. That's great, Patricia. Thank you all. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ramsey. And thank you, Patricia.
Okay, great to be with you.
All right, we'll see you later.
Thanks,
okay.
Andy.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Bye.
Is it good or bad either today?
We've been getting feedback from our listeners like, who is this other voice in the room? Is it another voice of Ramsey? We realize Mark and Ramsey sound a great deal alike. Mark is not the elephant in the room. He is our co-host and producer and sometimes moderator.
That is all true, although my voice is richer and deeper.
let's compare and contrast so people can tell the difference. This is Mark.
May me ma mo moo.
That was Ramsey.
And I think you can recognize my voice.
Yeah, Patricia, you're quite distinct. I don't think we're going to have a problem there.
So Mark, who is a multi-talented artiste. He's a composer. And
trumpeter.
Listen to some of his compositions. He's a humorist, a satirist, editor, music editor, and he is also producing a show on Air America Radio.
Yeah, I've been producing a comedy segment for the Mother Jones radio show, which is called Maury's Minute, with some really great voice people. So, you know, with the way politics have been going the last few years, there has been plenty of fodder for humor and satire. So that has been a really fun project.
So tell us a little bit more about Maury's Minute. You have a brother, too, sort of a well-known artiste.
Yeah, my brother is Ward Sutton, and he is a pretty well-known illustrator and comic artist. He does a syndicated strip in the Village Voice called Sutton Impact, and he also has a weekly strip in The Onion under a pseudonym. But I think it's the only one. So if you look at The Onion, you can kind of figure out it's him, which is really funny, and it's a completely different take than his normal humor, so it's great to see that. So we've collaborated on some other, you know, political projects and some animations for television. We got involved with the elections.
So tell us about Maury's Minute. What is that?
So Maury's Minute is a two-minute news parody segment, so it's a little bit like... Actually, Maury is a little bit like Stephen Colbert, although he existed before the Colbert Report. But he just does like a little fake news thing. And in fact, I could probably just play one for you right here.
That'd be great.
Let's hear that.
And now, back from unpaid administrative leave, it's Maury Meniscus. That's me. Dateline, the comeback trail. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Your man Maury is back on the story, and I have a new and improved intern, Billy.
At your side, Maury.
I'd like to take a moment to thank those of you who wrote in with your support.
Actually, we didn't receive any letters or emails, for that matter.
How about phone calls?
No, I don't think we got any calls.
Well, I felt the love all the same. Now to the news!
Wait, Maury. Don't forget to read the statement.
Oh, that's right.
React.
Well, that's, I don't like Maury.
I could say, well, where did you come up with that? That's his new voice.
He's not my friend.
Yeah, but and the voice of Maury, I should point out, is a great voice actor named Ken Schatz, who's amazingly talented and can do all sorts of different voices. And if you guys want to hear, if our listeners want to go listen to a little more, hear a whole bunch of those, go to Maury'sMinute.com, and that is MoreysMinute.com. Maury'sMinute.com.
And you've got your own website. I mean, you're a composer. You've done a lot of music for film and television and all kinds of media. And you've got your own website. It's
SuttonMusic.com.
Sutton Music. That's SuttonMusic. Music with a C.
Yep.
.com.
That's right.
Okay, so this is great that you're that we've now formed this triumvirate, and maybe Ramsey and I should interview you one day.
Okay, that sounds like fun. Yeah, when a guest cancels, that's our night. That's our backup.
That's what we'll do. That's our backup. Okay.
Or when I don't show up.
All right, cool. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay.
Visit us online at www.likemotherlikeson.org and let us know what you think of the show.
Good night.